Chapter 14. I put the car in park. I sat there watching the woman hanging up the shirts and pants and dresses on the clothesline. It was a good day for letting the late afternoon sun dry your clothes.
"How do we play this?" Franklin said. "Should I call it in?"
"In a minute," I said. "Let's just make sure we've got something here." I turned the car off and got out. Franklin followed me as I walked over to the woman by the laundry basket. She was an attractive woman, maybe pushing 40, but obviously not letting it slow her down. She moved with a brisk economy, like a woman who worked hard every day. She probably didn't have much choice, not with a house and a family that needed food and clean clothes. She stopped hanging another shirt when she spotted us walking across her yard. It was mostly weeds and crabgrass, but somebody was obviously keeping it all mowed.
"Can I help you?"
she said. Sorry to bother you, ma'am. We're just taking one more trip through this neighborhood. I'm sure someone else was here before."
"Looking for someone who killed that white woman."
Here's where she could have added her own comment about how black men get shot down every single day and nobody canvasses her neighborhood for them. But she didn't. "Yes, ma'am." Just as I was thinking about what to say next, the back door opened. A young man stepped out of the house. The hair, the high cheekbones. For 1/10 of a second, my brain was already sending a signal to my right hand to reach for my service revolver. But then the spell was broken as I put everything else together. This kid was a couple of years younger, 20 pounds lighter. He didn't have the muscular swagger of the kid I chased down the railroad tracks. Not even close. This was the kid who got his lunch money taken at recess, not the kid doing the taking.
"What's going on, Mom?"
the kid asked.
"It's nothing, Tremont. These police officers are just making the rounds again, like they did the other day."
The kid named Tremont gave me a shy look and a quick nod of his head.
"How are you?" Franklin said. "You like being out of school for the summer?"
"Yes, sir." "Don't know a kid who doesn't," the woman said.
How to ask this next question, I thought, without giving myself away. "Looks like a lot of mowing you got to do here," I said to her, nodding at her backyard. It wasn't real grass, but every square foot was mowed down to something that looked neat and trim anyway. "You got anybody else living here who can help you out?"
"It's just me and my two kids these past few years now. Please don't even ask about their daddy, because I try not to use profanity if I don't have to."
"Oh, two kids." I tried to keep my voice even. "No big deal. Just passing time here. You've got two kids, do tell." That's when the back door opened again. A little girl came out. She was 10 years old, maybe 11.
"That's Naima," the woman said. "Why they need to spend half the day inside watching television on a nice day like this?"
The girl came over and started picking through the clothes in the basket. She didn't so much as look in my direction. "Well," I said, already feeling deflated. "Okay, a boy and a girl. It looks like you've got your hands full here."
"No complaints, officer. We're doing just fine. God provides, and we are thankful."
I looked around at what she was thankful for. The house seemed to be in decent shape, but I could see water damage around the top floor windows. It needed new siding, too. I spotted the lawnmower beneath the one large tree at the back of the property. There was no shed to store it in, so it was rusted out, and I couldn't even imagine it starting, let alone cutting through all of these weeds. Next to that was a weight bench that had probably once belonged to the father before he ran off. On the other side of the tree, a swing hung haphazardly from a thick branch. Not a tire, but a plank of wood tilting a few degrees past level. Tremont jumped up onto it and began to swing back and forth, slowly. Something. There was something in that scene. Wait a minute. Wait one goddamned minute. "All right," I said. "Again, sorry to bother you. We'll let you finish up with your laundry."
"No bother at all," she said. "You gentlemen have a good rest of the day."
"Thank you," Franklin said. "It was very nice to meet all of you."
We went back to the patrol car.
"That obviously wasn't the kid you were looking for," Franklin said as he sat down beside me. "I'm glad we didn't call it in. Get everybody out here and make us look like fools."
I picked up the radio and hit the transmitter. "This is Unit 41. Is Detective Bateman still in the precinct?" A few seconds of radio silence, with my partner looking at me, waiting for an explanation.
Affirmative. 41, Detective Bateman is at his desk.
Ask him to wait for me, I said. We'll be there in a few minutes.
Okay, Franklin said when I put the transmitter back. Are you planning on telling me what the hell is going on at some point?
That woman was lying. I'm trying not to take it personally because I'm sure she thinks she's doing the right thing.
How do you know she's lying?
You saw that weight bench in the backyard?
Yes.
Do you think our little friend Tremont pumps a lot of iron?
I'm guessing it would kill him if he tried.
So who uses those weights?
The father, he said. He didn't take it all with him, so
yeah. That's what I thought, too. Then I noticed something.
What?
There were weight plates stacked on the ground.
Yeah, you got a weight bench, you're gonna have plates.
Did you also notice how well mowed that backyard was?
I did, he said. Are you approaching the point here, or are we gonna keep playing I Spy?
If the weightlifter in your family left, would you still keep picking up the plates, mowing under them, and then putting them back on the ground every time you mowed, for years? He thought about it for a moment.
Of course not, he said. I'd leave them stacked on the bench, or hell, I'd just throw them all in that old shed back there.
There you go, meaning that there's someone else living at that house, somebody who keeps himself in shape. He sat there looking at me as I drove back to the precinct.
Hot damn, Alex, he finally said, just when I thought you took too many foul balls off your mask.
The mother's name was Jamila King. The son named Tremont was in the public school system. So was the daughter, Naima. So was the other son, at least until recently. He was 2 years older than Tremont. His name was Darrow. He hadn't been in school since turning 16. He didn't have a driver's license. There was no employment record for Darrow King, or any other public record at all. But then, that wasn't unusual for a young black male in Detroit, where it's so easy to just disappear into the streets. Detective Bateman looked at the name on the high school transcript, the last official documentation of his existence before he dropped out.
Darrow King, he said.
Pleased to meet you, young man. I'd like to introduce you to our SWAT team.
I don't think that's the right play, I said. It's possible that this kid is inside that house right now, but it's just as possible he's somewhere else. If there's a record for him at that address, it wouldn't be smart to be there.
Look at this transcript and tell me this kid is smart.
You know there's more than one brand of smart, Detective. He's done a great job of staying off the radar, and obviously he has his mother working hard to keep it that way. You try to flush him out now, and he might disappear for good.
So what do we do? Watch the house? Wait him out?
That's how I'd approach it, yes.
Yeah, okay, he said. That's the way we do it. Did you see a good spot to park a van?
The street comes to a dead end, just a block away. Actually, there's a locked gate there. On the other side is the back of the parking lot for one of those apartment complexes on MLK.
Perfect, he said. We put our van in that lot, use the plumbing and heating sign, or the cable sign, either one. Have that gate unlocked so we can move through it quickly.
He picked up the phone to make the arrangements. At one point, while he was on hold, he looked up at me with a smile on his face.
What is it? I said. It's my new mission in life, once we catch this guy.
Yeah, what's that?
Get you your gold shield. You said you're taking the test, right?
Eventually.
Next test, you're taking it. You'll do great, of course. The rest is politics. That's where I come in.
Tell you what, I said. Let's just catch this guy. Then we can talk about gold shields. They rolled the van over that very evening. They parked it in the back of the parking lot, with a direct sight line to the house. We were lucky to have a street light on the corner as well, so there was no problem watching for people going in or out. I was immediately approved for overtime duty again. I spent the evening shift in the van with Detective Bateman. We didn't see anything happening at the house. We turned it over to a single night shift officer while we went home to sleep. Nothing happened. The detective and I were back in the van the next morning, holding large cups of coffee. We'd arranged with the apartment complex to use one of the empty units for bathroom breaks. It was the first time I'd ever done several consecutive hours of surveillance.
My first experience with such a new level of how to do absolutely nothing, with a single thread of anxiousness running through it so that you're never completely comfortable in your boredom. The day shift passed. The woman had come and gone with the daughter Naima. The son Tremon had come and gone. That was it. It was evening now. I was going on 14 straight hours of this, wondering if my sanity would hold if I had to come right back here the next day. They could have done this without me, theoretically. Just wait for a stranger to show his face and then call out the dogs, drag him in, and bring me down to identify him. But I was the one person who could pick out this kid before blowing our cover. That was an advantage nobody else could bring to the van.
"I'm gonna be pissed if that kid's been inside the house this whole time," Bateman said. "He could be eating pizza and watching television."
"I admit," I said, "I'm starting to rethink my original idea. Even if he's not there, the mother would have to give him up eventually, wouldn't she?" The detective looked away from the little observation window.
"The long hours are making you delirious, Alex, like she'd ever do that in a million years."
I took my turn at the window. It was getting close to midnight, time for the night shift officer to relieve us. Then I saw the headlights. A beat-up old car came rolling down the street, slowly. It stopped in front of the house. The headlights were turned off. The driver waited a full minute to get out. When he did, he was just a shadow in the darkness, backlit by the streetlight behind him. But I recognized the body type. I recognized the way he moved. "Hey, detective," I said, not taking my eyes off him. "I thought you said this kid didn't have a driver's license."
"He doesn't."
"Well, then, we'll have something else to charge him with." He came over to the window and looked out at the house.
"Is that our man?"
"He must have missed his mother's home cooking," I said.
"Let's go get him."
We called for backup first. No sense doing anything stupid now that we had him pinned in the house. As soon as the squad cars rolled up, Bateman dispatched units to all four sides of the house. Then he went up on the front porch and banged on the door.
"Open up! Police!"
Silence.
"Daryl, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. Just come on out and nobody will get hurt."
The door opened. A figure stood in the doorway.
"Get on the ground!"
Bateman yelled, his gun pointed right at the kid's chest.
"Turn around and lie face down, right now!"
I don't know if you can give the kid credit for this or not, but he kept standing there, calling the detective's bluff, like he was saying, "Go ahead and shoot me." In the end, the detective walked right up to him and tackled him. A dozen other officers swarmed the house then, guns drawn. A police dog was barking. The radios were all squawking in unison. I stood back by the sidewalk, watching the pandemonium, feeling oddly out of place. All of these officers belonged to another squad, after all. They were virtual strangers to me. Now they were all working together to back up Detective Bateman on the big arrest. I was finally called inside to make the official ID. I walked up the porch steps and looked down at the young man lying on the floor. His hands were cuffed behind his back. There was a fresh scrape on his forehead from where he'd been pushed down onto the hardwood floor. He looked up at me. It was him. This was the man I had chased down the tracks. The mother was screaming. The little sister was crying. I saw the brother running down the hallway into the bathroom. If you had anything resembling a human heart, you knew that this was another family devastated by the crime. Daryl King was picked up off the floor and taken away. I filled out some paperwork while Daryl King was booked, fingerprinted, and put in a holding cell. He hadn't said a word yet, not to anybody, not even to his mother. She had been brought down to the station with her son, because of course you can't interrogate a minor without a parent or guardian in the room. I waited around for a couple more hours. The mother was doing all of the talking, telling us all we had made a big mistake. She didn't want a lawyer for her son. She said Daryl didn't need a lawyer because he hadn't done anything. It was a mistake I'd seen play out again and again over the years, and it never stopped surprising me. If the police arrest you, put you in a room, then ask you if you know anything about anything, don't say a word until you have a lawyer at your side, even if you know you haven't done anything wrong. But with Daryl not talking and his mother playing the same tape over and over again, there didn't seem to be much hope of a confession before we had to formally charge him based only on my ID and the fingerprints on the bracelet. The sergeant on duty patted me on the back and sent me home. Jeannie was asleep when I got home. She was gone the next morning when I woke up. It was late, but I had been given that day off. I made dinner reservations. I was looking forward to having a normal life again, maybe recapturing something with Jeannie before it was too late. That's what I was thinking. But then it turned out she had a late class that evening. I had totally forgotten about it, and she didn't want to skip it. I told her I understood. We made a makeup date for that weekend. She told me she was proud of me. She told me that she loved me. That was the last time she'd ever say that. That was the last day of June, meaning I was rolling over to nights. At least this time, I wasn't doing it coming off a short shift. But when I got to the precinct for the midnight roll call, there was a little surprise waiting for me.
"Bateman got it," Sergeant Grimaldi said to me. "He got the confession."
"What are you talking about?" I said. "I thought we had given up."
"What can I tell you? He took one more shot at it."
"Did somebody think maybe they should call me and let me know?"
"If Bateman didn't do that," he said, "then I should have. I apologize."
"It's all right. Can I see the confession at least?"
"Sure thing. You know what? Detective Bateman will be here when you get back from your shift. So go find him and make him play the tape for you. I don't think you'll have much problem getting him to relive his big moment of glory."
I could tell Sergeant Grimaldi was still feeling bad about how I'd been left out of the loop when the case was closed. So he made sure I got a big round of applause at the roll call. I tried to wave it off, and then I stood up and told everyone that Franklin deserved some of the credit, which was the absolute truth. I had driven us there, but I was just about to drive away. Then Franklin saw the shirt with the torn sleeve being put on the clothesline.
"You didn't have to do that," he said to me when we got in the car.
"Yes, I did. Maybe it's about time for you to get a gold shield, too." He smiled and shook that off. As we rolled out, we knew we had a long 8 hours ahead of us. That first night was always the hardest, whether you were short-shifting or not. You're trying to fool your body into staying awake and alert through 8 hours in the dark. Your body knows a lie when it hears one, so you just try to pace yourself, deal with everything that comes up, talk to the knuckleheads, try to keep a lid on things, and have as peaceful a night as you can possibly manage. It was yet another hot summer night. There would be nothing peaceful about it. There was a disturbance at the hospital on Woodward Avenue. The place was already the epicenter of that city's hot summer, with gunshot victims being wheeled into the ER every night. It was a job I couldn't even imagine, dealing with that over and over. Now there was apparently a Code 35 wandering around the ER waiting room. A Code 35 is a mentally disturbed person. What happened next is a story that changes a little bit every time I tell it. It was all too much to take in when it was actually happening. Years go by, and I'll remember little details for the first time. We went into the lobby. We talked to the receptionist. She told us that the man had been bothering the inpatients all night. At one point, he had tried to hide behind the plants. She had heard this man lived down the street in a high-rise apartment building. It was a building Franklin and I had visited more than once. It was one of those addresses you knew immediately, as soon as you heard it on the radio. Oh, great, this place again. The elevator was broken. We had to take the stairs. Franklin complained with every step. His knee was hurting. We had gone back to the sports banner that night, everything back to normal. Football versus baseball, the endless argument. The man was named Rose. We went into his apartment and sat him down at his kitchen table. There was aluminum foil on the walls. In the middle of our pleas for him to stop bothering the people at the hospital, he took out the Uzi from beneath the table. It had been taped to the underside. In that endless minute, he had the gun pointed at us, ready to shoot the second either of us moved. He told us he had found it in a dumpster. Not an unusual find in a summer filled with gun battles over the crack trade. I hate thinking about what comes next. It's something I replay in my head, and I always try to make turn out differently. But of course, it never does. He shot Franklin 5 times. He shot me 3 times. That's what you can do with an Uzi, before either one of us could even get our revolvers out of their holsters. I lay on the floor, looking up at the ceiling, which Rose had neglected to line with aluminum foil. I can still see that ceiling when I close my eyes at night. Franklin died on the floor next to me. He left behind a wife and two daughters. I was still in the hospital when they held the service for him, then put him in the ground. Jeannie told me she would stick it out, but the wife of a cop thing had already been wearing her down. This was much worse, and I can still remember that expression on her face as she looked down at me in my hospital bed, like this was all just too much. When I finally got back on my feet, I spent a lost year drinking and taking painkillers, and one day, a few weeks into that dark period, Jeannie left me. Although I suppose you could argue that I had already left her in my own way. I guess it really doesn't matter in the end. I was off the police force on 2/3 disability. I never went back. When I was pulling myself back together after that year, I came up to Paradise to sell off the cabins my father had built. I've been up here ever since, but if I thought I could run away from my past, I was sorely mistaken. It always finds you, even in the most remote little town you can imagine, even in a town called Paradise. Even now, when I think I've finally come to terms with everything that happened in my life, I find something new. I can look back on that last summer in Detroit, past the shooting, to that one last big case I helped solve, all these years later, and somehow, it's just coming to me that I never did get the chance to see that confession, and that this young man may have been innocent of the crime for which he was charged, and worse, that the real killer walked free, possibly to kill again, possibly all because we missed something that would have pointed to him. We could have stopped him then. That was the one thing I couldn't get over. If we were so goddamn smart, we could have charged Daryl King with robbery, and maybe tampering with a crime scene, put him on probation, given him back to his mother, and then gone out and found the man who really killed Elena Page. I was cut down by a madman myself, after all. A madman who got caught just a few days later and put away forever. So how could I live with myself now, knowing that in that same hot summer, I may have missed my chance to catch an even bigger monster?